Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. An initiative uniting climate activist Greta Thunberg and the UN Health Agency launched on Monday to give young activists the opportunity to get funding for innovative solutions to the impact of COVID-19. The scheme, which is called Global Youth Mobilization, in association with the Big Six youth organizations, comes as hundreds of millions of young people continue to feel the strain of the pandemic. According to the World Health Organization, WHO, 9 in 10 have reported increased mental anxiety during the last 15 months, and more than 1 billion students in almost every country have been impacted by school closures. More than 8 in 10 young women are worried about their future, and 1 in 6 young people worldwide have lost their jobs during the pandemic, the health agency noted. Head of the WHO, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, insisted that the agency wanted to be sure that young people's voices, energy and solutions were at the center of the world's recovery from COVID-19. An initial $2 million of funding will be available, from $500 to $5,000. Applications will be possible via a centralized platform, which is available in multiple languages. For more information, visit www.globalyouthmobilization.org. To Guatemala now, where a UN-appointed independent rights expert has voiced concerns over alleged ongoing harassment and intimidation of judges. UN Special Rapporteur Diego García Sayán spoke out on Monday after Congress's refusal to reappoint a top lawmaker who is known for her human rights-based approach to the country's constitutional court. Judge Gloria Porras, who is the former president of the court, was re-elected in March. She had been due to resume her duties for another five-year term last week until Congress refused to her swearing in. The judge faces an impeachment investigation, and Congress has also established an investigative commission to withdraw her immunity, said the UN Special Rapporteur. The Special Rapporteur on the Independence of Judges and Lawyers also noted that a number of politicians affected by her decisions as president of the Constitutional Court have already threatened to file civil and criminal action against her. Finally, an official UK report into racism and ethnic disparities distorts and falsifies historic fact and could even fuel racism, discrimination and negative racial stereotypes, UN-appointed rights experts said on Monday. The United Kingdom's Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities, which was set up by the government after the Black Lives Matter protests began last year, presented its report in March. In a statement, the UN Working Group of Experts of People of African Descent challenged the report's assertion that while there might be overt acts of racism in the UK, there was no institutional racism. The panel said that despite considerable research and evidence of institutional racism, the report attempts to normalize white supremacy. This was an unfortunate sidestepping of the opportunity to acknowledge the atrocities of the past and the contributions of all in order to move forward, the UN panel maintained. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
I think we've got him.
Hey, Mike.
All right, you're on. Wonderful.
I'm on.
Listeners, John Grant, our Tuesday, our favorite guest on Tuesdays, our favorite guest on Radio Free Kansas, frankly. And according to Diane at the Little Apple in Manhattan, Kansas. That's what they call Manhattan.
Well,
Kansas.
Of course.
The Little Apple.
The Little Apple.
This is the Little Apple out there. It's really basically central Kansas, north central Kansas, you could sort of.
Right.
The site of the Kansas State University. And interestingly enough, it's also the site of an up-and-coming in construction for the last 5 years, next door to the campus and right across the, maybe a block from Bramlage Coliseum, the sporting arena that is, largely vacated here in our plague, in the plague year, but will soon be flooded with human beings. And across the street from that is the Senator Pat Roberts, National Agricultural Biological Research Lab, which most of the locals just call a germ warfare lab, which is about to go online, very similar to the Wuhan lab that is next door to the epicenter of the coronavirus 19 in China. It's a I just wanted to bring that up because I want to let Diane in Manhattan, one of our loyal listeners, know that we're well aware out here in Radio Free Kansas land what could go down and how dangerous
wrong. Pretty scary. Yeah.
John.
Huh?
Yeah, we really do. I think we do live in dangerous times. I really do. I think,
no question about it. And sometimes, lunatics are driving the clown car, and we're in the back seat.
I shudder at the thought of you and I at the driver's seat. I mean, what's what?
Oh, come on. We're good drivers. Go to you, cut it out.
Yeah, I think I would be in. Oh, God, speaking of you heard about the Tesla car crashing and burning?
Yes, I heard that yesterday. Yeah. There was a guy in the passenger seat and a guy in the back seat, and it just careened off and, hit something and blew up. It's like incredible.
What do you want to bet that they were? The first thought I had, of course, this is revealing to the listeners. The first thought I had was they got drunk at a pub and just programmed the car and went to sleep.
I don't know.
I wonder what their blood alcohol, I wonder what that is.
Or maybe they'd smoked a joint and they were playing some tapes and they were just totally into it,
Yeah, supposedly, it sort of looked like from the description of the partial one that I picked up on was that it was doing maybe 80 miles an hour when it ran off the road into a tree, and it reminded me of another wreck recently of what's his name, the golf guy. What is his name?
Tiger Woods. Tiger Woods. Yeah.
Tiger Woods. That, it reminded me of the same kind of wreck, Man.
Yeah, it's consistent with him falling asleep, wouldn't you think? Maybe he was a little drunk, too. I don't know.
Tiger Woods.
Tiger is a real party guy,
Well, supposedly he was just roaring. It came roaring out of his domicile, and it's a curvy road down. I don't know enough about it, but it says something that there are people out there, dying in robot cars, and we got a biological weapons lab about to start up. I've watched it before. It's been in construction for years.
Well,
over there,
Mary Shelley wrote the ultimate book on this called Frankenstein. Back in the 19th century, she was 19 when she wrote it, and she had this vision of, science going awry. As a metaphor, they haven't solved that one yet. Every once in a while, the things go wrong and the monster goes awry.
Well, but then if you get to talking about this too much, then somebody like Rachel Maddow or somebody on YouTube will say, "Oh, you're a conspiracy theorist."
I see. Mary Shelley was a conspiracy theorist. Okay. That's probably okay. I'm sure people will make that argument. But to me, she was a writer and she had a vision and it stuck around, of course it became great entertainment with Boris Karloff and the Bride of Frankenstein and got her a girlfriend and all that.
Who knows how many horror movies are made about that? Who knows how many movies are made about
that? Yeah, how many horror movies are based on the same premise as Frankenstein about, technology going awry, think of the Challenger, the great, teacher was going up into space, it wasn't a scientific error. It was a human error, because the President of the United States, Ronald Reagan, wanted to say hello and speak to the teacher on his State of the Union message that night, special hookup with the space. They broke the rules of sensibility and sent the goddamn thing up in, like, freezing weather, and those famous O-rings leaked stuff out, and it just blew up because the President of the United States wanted some really, really slick PR. Well, that's, again, human fallibility leading to technological disaster. Well, we've been there.
Uh-huh.
You know, it could happen again, you know, in many contexts, you know. Sorry. We'll have to rethink that one, you know. And Elon Musk, you know, he's the point. He could get away with murder, you know. This guy could do anything because he is the coolest guy around, you know. He's got space. Talk about going up in space, you know. He's like, got his own NASA operation, you know. I mean, this guy is on the cutting edge. And, of course, I mean, the idea of driverless cars just terrifies me. I don't want any part of it. But, you know, I don't have an iPhone either, so I've been rejecting technology for some time. And, of course, the iPhone and the Internet has backfired the same way as the Frankenstein story, you know, because we used to think this was great liberating, you know, technology. Well, the dark web and all this, we're scared to death of the internet now.
And we return to QAnon. QAnon.
Yeah. There you go. QAnon is like Frankenstein, you know. You know, a guy with the bolts in his head, you know.
Well, how about this? A poll came out. There's a lot of people with bolts in their neck. Because a recent poll came out that still, after all this stuff, 40 million Republicans are estimated still thinking Donald Trump really won the election.
Well, that's their choice. I just saw Sean Hannity interviewing him in Mar-a-Lago last night, and of course he's ready to win again and all this. I don't think he's going to even run, but who knows? Amazing things can happen in 2 and 4 years. In 2022, the question is, will the midterm elections follow pattern and go against the sitting party of the president, which it often does. But in this case, because Donald Trump was such a clown car, you know, that I think, and because of things that Biden's doing, you know, how many of those 74 million people that voted for Donald Trump, for instance, have cashed their stimulus check? And how many of them have actually torn it up or sent it back? You know, I mean, as a point of contention here. I don't imagine many, if any, have, you know. And so that, you know, the economy's going to pick up. Yeah, granted, we'll be in a huge debt, and that could come and bite us in the ass eventually. But, you know, infrastructure. You know, Donald Trump was talking about an infrastructure bill. He never did a damn thing about it. And, you know, this stuff is happening. And Donald Trump is, you know, I have people telling me in Vets for Peace that Donald Trump was more anti-war than Barack Obama. I'm going like, wait a goddamn minute. What are you talking about?
Well, there's an argument.
No, and he may have a case. He may have a case.
Wait a minute.
Okay. Okay, we can talk about it.
Let me. Cause we have Trumpsters out here listening.
Well,
okay. So
dial us up. Let's talk this stuff over. You know,
I will play the great orange one. Okay, and I will explain to you that in his bombastic statements in his debate with all those other Republicans, he did a great job nailing those bastards to the wall in the primary.
Absolutely,
and he did it publicly. And he did it with the vulgarity that many in the working class appreciated and laughed at.
I think you're right on.
He did such a scathing, vulgar, humorous performance on his opponents in the primary that it established his streak. Now, when my theory, and this is not a theory, I can base it a lot.
Okay.
Once he was elected, being the grifter con real estate guy, I mean, who would elect a real estate fuck? Have you ever bought a house from a real estate agent? You better treat them like used car. You need to treat them like used
car. Oh, yeah. Well, I remember the one that did us, yeah. And he didn't bother to tell us that suddenly the rates were climbing. You know, he had this shit-eating grin over there. And you know, he might have told us that, you know, but he didn't, but. We're
veering off on the left curve of the road here. But hold on, idiot, the great orange idiot king became king, and I there's many reports that he really didn't expect to win. It was all show, just to fuck.
Oh, that's when 16, of course, yeah.
He could get his brand out there, and once he got in there, he goes, oh shit, I did say we were going to end the endless war. What the fuck? Well, can we do that? He goes to the Pentagon of all places and talks to the press. And they say, hell no, we can't do that. It'll be the end of the world. And actually, they're correct.
Right.
It'll be the end of their fucking careers, okay?
Right.
He says, well, I don't want to do that. I don't want to run you out of a job. So I'll just tell him, you know, we can't do it right now.
Right.
That's what he did for 4 years. He did that on not this war.
Right.
He did that on fucking everything. He didn't do shit except take care of the wealthy.
True. Let me tell you
how I
responded to this clown.
Wait a minute. I did get a check.
Please do. Go ahead.
And it was signed by him for $1,200. And by God, yeah, I put it in the fucking bank. All right, but you know, I mean,
absolutely. Yeah.
But that was the kiss. That was the kiss off.
Right.
You know, that was the kiss off. That's why I look at it. Here's some money, and there's evidently 40 million people that continue to listen to him for months, not days, months after he lost the election, and he was working another fucking scam, you know?
Right.
This guy
right.
works scams faster than, you know, I think that's...
No question. But
tell me about the interview. Tell me about the interview.
Oh, okay, anyway, this fella comes up, and you know, he's hostile to me and some other people. We have internal squabbles. That's normal. But and he says, Donald Trump was more anti-war than Obama. And I'm going, well, you know, I understand your point. I take your point. What you're missing is you're looking at this as political personalities. The reason that Donald Trump is more anti-war than Obama is because history moves forward. And by the time you get to Donald Trump, history is suggesting that this war really is pointless. You're losing it. You'll lose it, continue to lose it. It just goes on and on and on and on. And so it is not the personality of these leaders. It's the momentum of the war and the momentum, you know, the large consensus of the war is that there's no future in it. It's going nowhere. We've basically lost it. It's another tragic thing. We told them they were going to, the same as Vietnam and Iraq and all this stuff. You know, I mean, told you so. You know, we told you 14 years ago, whatever the hell it was, 20 years ago. But the point is, history is the reason that, okay, if you consider Donald Trump more anti-war than Obama, well, Joe Biden is clearly more anti-war than both of those guys, you know, because he has already told the Pentagon, sorry, pal, we're going to get out on the 20th anniversary of September 11th. Yeah, well, you can't do that because you're telling the Taliban when you're doing. He says, fuck you, I can do it, and I did it, you know, which is, I think, a profile and courage of sorts on the part of this guy Biden. You know,
we got to keep
his feet to the fire. He may be a hypocrite. He may go back on all this. They're going to keep CIA people there. You know that. So I'm not Pollyanna-ish about this, but you know, his decision to do this is really the most interesting thing that's happened in the anti-war world vis-a-vis Afghanistan since the beginning. Again, we got to keep this guy Joe Biden's feet to the fire. But,
well,
you know, okay.
Yeah, but
you say Donald Trump is more anti-war than Obama. Well, clearly Biden is more anti-war than... I mean, it's really
horrible.
A ridiculous idea to say
well,
the
we'll
president
see.
Anti-war.
Well, first off, what's the old expression? I was thinking about this morning while I was laying, coming off of a pretty deep binge. We were building more machinery to print the Discomfort magazine last night.
Right.
So we had a party. It was a birthday party, too, so we threw it all together and, like, you know, had some fun. And I was waking up, and I thought, what is that? Skin in the game. That's what the expression is. Who's got skin in the game?
Right.
But didn't Biden have a son that was in the military who died?
Yeah, well, Biden's son, Beau, who has since died
of
brain cancer, was, you know, he was a soldier in Iraq, yeah.
Right.
You know,
and
Don Jr. and whatever the hell the other guy's name is, Eric, you know, you're not going to see those boys in uniform. That's for damn sure, you know.
And wasn't there, John, this is the question I have. That's floating around. I haven't looked at the total content of the letter that allegedly Biden wrote to Obama and said, I guess it was even handwritten, saying we should not be going in. You know, we've got to get out of this shit. You know, we've got to get out of the Middle East. Isn't there a letter floating around that Biden wrote to Obama saying something to the effect of that?
Well, I think he shared that with Obama, and Obama said, hey, you're the man now. Do what you want. You know, I'm not absolutely certain that's what he said, but that's kind of what I heard. Obama's not going to make any waves. Obama... He knows the story here. You know, his record, like Clinton's, is under scrutiny. And, you know, the guy in the hot seat is the man, you know.
Yeah, well, this allegedly was a letter or a note he sent to Obama.
Right.
Literally during the surge when Obama was president.
Oh,
yeah. I'll dig it up. And
yeah,
listeners,
that'd be interesting.
You could do some research. Research on this, but yeah, I think Biden's got skin in the game, and his much maligned, addicted, substance abusive addicted
right.
son Hunter, who has been just like roasted so many times, I can't even keep track of how many.
They're still cooking him on Fox News every night.
Yeah, and I think he may call it a hallucination or a psychotic break. He went out. He went and joined the Navy or something at 38.
Really?
And he couldn't make it. He couldn't make it.
He was snorting too much crack at the time, probably.
Yeah, or coke, you know. I'd like to think he probably had coke.
Of course, rich white guy. He had
blue
coke.
Blue blood, white boy, yeah. you know. And he immediately went back into rehab when he crashed and burned in the military. So, and I don't know. This is a recurring skin in the game type thing, you know. I think working class people can relate to Biden in a different way than Obama or Donnie Trump if they just give him a chance. I think that's
we'll see. He's certainly pleasantly surprised me. I didn't expect him to do these sort of FDR type things as much as he's doing. And so, as I say, let's keep his feet to the fire. In the meantime, let me ask you something.
Yeah.
My dear wife here, Luann, has read The Ragged Trousered Philanthropist, you know, the insert here, or the first edition of it, or whatever the chapters, in your Discomfort. And she wants to give a report, a testimonial. She loves it.
Good.
Are we ready for that now, or what?
I don't know if I can handle it, but I'll try. All right.
Okay. Well, here's the literary critic, Luann Merkel.
Excellent.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
Hey, listeners, Luann Merkel is the very significant other of John Grant. How long have you guys been together?
30 years.
Oh, good
yeah.
for you. All right, see?
I know.
That's great. Well, yeah, so listeners, in the second issue of Discomfort, we started a installment of KU Confidential and of a book I had no knowledge of until a socialist professor, a retired professor who's a flaming socialist in Kansas City, sent me. He said, Mike, have you ever read this book? And I started looking it up, and I thought, no. And he goes, you need to check that. It's right down the line of Discomfort. I never knew what he said. And I read it, and then I read a book about the book, and I read about and I, listeners, it's the most weirdest book I've ever read. It's called The Ragged Trouser Philanthropist by, not his real name, Robert Tressel, which is not his real name. What do you think so far since you've read the first preface in the first chapter, Luann?
It was such a treat. I was blown away by the skill this guy had in nailing the arguments that people use about socialism. Every single argument that he writes about in 1903, we heard from, you know, the right wing about, you know, Bernie Sanders and socialism now, every single one. And this writer, you know, Robert Tressel or whoever his name is such a good writer. It is a treat for me to read him because the way he creates his characters, it's like we know these people. You know, we could say, oh, my God, that's so-and-so at the pool that I see every week. Or, you know, it's just I mean, these are real people that were alive in 1903, and they live today. And so, I mean, for me, I was underlining every single one and then just putting a note, this is the argument against immigrants. You know, we got to blame the immigrants for stealing our jobs, you know. And then he would go on to the next argument. And I just, you know, you're going to take all our money or, you know, one thing or another. And he just did it so gracefully and methodically and carefully and thoroughly that by the time it was all done, you just felt like you really learned something, you know? And so for me, I'm on the edge of my seat waiting for the next installment. But the other problem that I have to say with Discomfort,
yes.
It is so rich. I mean, I'm somebody who, of course, loves the Victorian or the old, what all these designs that you've got in here that have humor, that are well-crafted, that are intriguing. You're drawn into the humor and to the skill of the artist. And then you bring it into the real world. Bernie. You've got little Bernie Sanders with his mittens everywhere. You've got to caution Bernie Sanders. He's at the insurrection, you know. You've got everything about the lawns. Everything is so relevant. I was a beam on a skyscraper, you know. And I just, it's a delight, you know. It's one of these things, it's like a live wire. I felt like, oh, my God, this is like R. Crumb from the 60s, you know. And then the work... You know, the worker's maypole on the back, the art is beautiful, and then you're hitting us over the head. We don't have 8 hours because, you know, it just happened that way. It was blood and work, you know, for unions to build this up. And, you know, I can be riding in my car and hearing NPR talk about, you know, well, because of Amazon and Bezos, the unions were never going to happen, you know, and they just are burying unions right and left. And then now, we've got Discomfort. And we're not dead yet. And so what you're doing is you are grounding us in history. And it's exciting, it's familiar, it's relevant. And then you've got, I mean, I love Indian mogul paintings. You know, I did a painting of the Taj Mahal. Mogul, you know, Shah Jahan, who built the Taj Mahal.
Oh,
and they're Indian from India miniatures. And you've got all these, I guess, the medieval illuminators who also did the Bible pages by hand. You've got
yeah.
those borders in here. I mean, you've got, like, William Morris borders in here. So for an artist,
right.
I'm like, I'm all, oh, here, this is mine. Oh. I mean, I circled things in this article, and I named them. You know, the poor will always be among us. I put John's brother's name there because that's John's brother's favorite quote for why we're not going to deal with the poor. They're always going to be with us, you know?
Kill them.
Oh. Oh, my God. It was just one thing after another. So imagine me, I'm out in my backyard, right? I'm eating my lunch. And I've got this comfort on the table with my pencil. I'm underlining, exclamation point.
That's terrible.
Here's another, another thing is women, okay? There's thousands of them nowadays doing the work that ought to be done by men. We hear that. We hear that.
Oh, that's what they say. Yeah, yeah.
Right, so at any rate, so I have to tell you, I think we're in an epical shift. And I think that what you're providing a major service. And I took your discomfort and I sent it to a change agent here in Philly with a long, effusive recommendation that she settle down and read this, take a look at it. Not because she needs to be educated, but because she's going to enjoy resonating with somebody who's on the same page. So. And then there's a guy in New Hampshire, Fowley, F-O-L-W-E, and he's got the New Hampshire Gazette. You should Google it, New Hampshire Gazette, you know, and he's in New Hampshire, what you're doing in Kansas. So you know, I've talked enough. I mean, I don't know if that any of it made sense, but I'm just...
Oh, no, it did. I really appreciate that, and because... You know, it's I consider it. It's the combination. You know, it's only the third issue to me it's a combination of it. I want to try to make it mysterious in a way, enigmatic, a riddle, and a work of art at the same time. I don't know.
It is.
I was.
You got it.
Do you ever read? Do you ever look at Jacobean or Jacobean, the magazine that the Jacobean. But you know what I'm talking about. It's like a magazine comes out every 2 months. Yeah. You know, they are just lavish. I mean, and I've got to give them a hat tip because they, you know, they sort of inspired me. But I've tried to do it, and I think, wow, what's going to happen if you run out, if you can't just, you know, write something in the old way, have it sent to the printer, and the printer prints it for you, and it's in beautiful, lavish color. Well, what happens if, you know, some of these people screw up majorly and the power goes out for, say, 30 days? You know, not as a doom thing, but it's like, I said, I'm going to set this thing up that I can run it literally out of my cottage, literally out of my 10 acres, and go for, as long as we have the United States Postal Service, which we will, no matter what, that this has some resilience and longevity that people, years from now, as climate change descends upon us even with even more horrifying consequences, that they'll be able to read this. So it's Jacobean and a book called The Road by Cormac McCarthy, which is also a movie, by the way, listeners, that inspired me to take up discomfort in a way where I can do it all from the 10 acres as long as I have electricity and enough supplies, which I already have enough supplies to go for. I've got paper.
I'm telling
paper,
you,
toner.
I you know, I'm a total fan. It's a cultural treasure, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I want it to be something that people can keep and goes back and makes people say, hey, you know, they got through this in the 1890s and 19 up to 1910 or whatever, and we can get through it. We can get through it again. You know,
that is really, really, really a good reminder, because as we all know, we're freaking out. I'm on this group for our county, and we're planning the response to, you know, the verdict on the Chauvin trial, and, you know, people are just, like, in full throttle panic, you know, and I'm just like,
What are they panicking about?
I'm afraid to say it, you know, they're like, burn it all down,
well,
you know, they're like, and these are two people on a whole, you know, two of many, 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 many voices. It's not unlike, you know, the ragged trousered philanthropist, you know, the many, many voices. But among those voices, one of the extremes is just like the policing system has been murdering black men, women, and children for, you know, generations. And and that it's taking them this long to get to a verdict just says that the system is so broken, when it's obvious to anybody looking at it who's not a, you know, an apologist for the police system that Chauvin murdered George Floyd. You know, what's taking so long? And so they're like, you know, we just have to throw it all out. But we've heard that before. But, I mean, that's going to be in discomfort. You know, we've heard that before. I don't know. I don't have.
So you actually see people that say burn it all down? It's like it's all internet. Well, you don't have that out here, but what you have is a lot of people panicking from a different poll. They allege everything's already burned down because of Bernie Sanders, and the socialists have taken over the country. The cities are burning. Don't you know Philadelphia is just a big crater right now, an ash, smoke-filled crater from the demonstrations, or, you know.
Oh, my God.
We were
at the demonstrations.
This is the
mentality. We had a ball.
You used the word panic. But that's the panic from out here, and that's what they do out here. They get it. It's like, well, you know, watch what happens. People are going to go crazy and burn down more. Attack our businesses, people like us in businesses and in the cities, you know, and it's really hysterical.
Well, this is why you've got to meet Judy Wicks. She's an entrepreneur who's now retired, and she's got this vision of local economy, building a local economy, and she's building a bridge between the producers in, you know, kind of right-wing rural areas with the entrepreneurs in the city. So it's all about food, you know, and clothes. And she's saying, you know, we have to stop relying on these corporations and do what we need to. I don't need to tell you about this. That we need to do for ourselves and stop relying on, you know, all this corporate stuff that is destroying the planet. And so she's got a philosophy that she's saying, let's put the fear aside and the name calling aside. And you over here, you're growing these wonderful things that the people in the city want and can sell for you. And so she's introducing them, and they're collaborating on getting money and sustaining themselves. And instead of, you know, the boogeyman about socialism or name-calling of any ism, it's real people doing real work that they enjoy doing and benefiting from each other. And so it's probably, at any rate, she's the one I sent your discomfort to, because I think she would love it. And you should have her on your show.
Sure. No problem. Yeah. That's
so
no problem.
At any rate, I think you're going places, Mike, and I am super excited to get the next copy and keep reading it. And it was fun to see John's piece 3 Wednesdays in January. That was cool.
That's one of those I want people 20 years from now to know about.
Yeah.
That's why I look at it. 10 years, 20 years.
Yeah.
I want something there. That's what I'm doing. Well, thanks, Luann. What a wonderful. Wow. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's not just me. That's the whole point. It really requires the input. Moots, inside cover article on the monarch butterflies was a real hit for me. It was a special grab. On its spur, I bugged her for weeks and weeks to write something. Hell, maybe months. And she's a very good writer. She's a much more clinical, clear writer than I am. So I didn't know. I gave her like a temper tantrum over the telephone, and finally I said, look. You got 3 days. Come up with something, because we don't. She gives me this thing about butterflies, and I'm looking at it. And I'm going, and she's a real warrior against the patriarchy too. So I thought, I'll just put a bunch of angry old white men coming out of the Capitol building on January 6th.
Absolutely.
Kill all monarchs, because yeah. That was an inside joke I shouldn't share, but I wanted to share it with you. That Mood is. I hope she'll come back and give us some more of her environmental. And she was the one that told me what the word locavores mean. I did not know what there were. What locavores?
Now, see, that's what Judy Wicks is all about. That is her Yeah. So John is like chomping at a bit, wanting to.
Yeah.
Oh, he denies that. He denies it.
It's all right. It's okay. Well, I'm glad you came on.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me.
If you could figure out what you'd like to put in the magazine yourself, please. That's why listeners, most of you get pre-addressed stamped envelopes stuck inside there for you to write notes and send to me.
I noticed that, and I said, anybody who's going to do that, I have to reply. I can't waste that stamp, so I'm building up to it. I am going to, more of discomfort to finish, and Kill All Monarchs is definitely one of them. I mean, I've got tons of monarchs. Not tons, but, I've been inviting them into our yard. I mean, my butterflies.
But you see them.
Do
you really
see
them?
Yeah, I mean, all you have to do is plant milkweed, and they tend to show up, which is shocking.
Yeah,
it's like quick before they go extinct, might as well do that. So,
yeah.
I mean, I've read a little bit about it, and they say don't raise hundreds of them, but if you want to raise 30, that's cool. Leave the rest out there.
Uh-huh.
I have a neighbor who raised 300, but they say that's kind of overdoing it. I couldn't do it.
It's
a full-time job.
Overdoing it.
Well,
I don't know about that. But I'll tell you this. I don't know that even that you can raise them. I don't know anything about that, but I'll tell you this.
I raise them?
Our 10 acres... Our 10 acres, monarch butterflies. I didn't know you could do that.
What you do is you save them from their natural predators. Okay.
Yeah, but
so
don't they migrate? Don't they migrate all the way down to South America? How the hell do they do that?
Well, they're called instars, and so there's like five generations that it takes in order to make the full round trip to Mexico. So they leave Mexico, and then they come up and they come north, and they have a couple of different routes they take. And the guys that come my direction, I get like the last instar, the fifth, and that's the one. They come really late, so they come like in September, and late August, September. And those are the ones that live the longest, and they make the full trek back to Mexico. And so it's always scary because they have to go through its hurricane season down south. And so my friend at one point actually had her last straggler, and she knew there was a hurricane, and she happened to be driving to Virginia, and she put the guy in the car with her and took him past the bad weather and let him out in Virginia somewhere. But I think... I don't know. There's all kinds of things about their homing devices that if you make mistakes about... Okay, John says he's chomping at the bit. Enough about the butterflies, but here he is. Okay.
No. Okay. Well, I'll tell you what. We'll come up with some stories. That's a great story. I never knew about that. I didn't know they took generations to get up here. I did not know
they
that.
They do.
Wonderful.
They
thank
do.
You, man.
They do.
Yeah.
They're amazing. And so what it means to nurture these guys is you plant the milkweed. And the little caterpillars, you plant the milkweed, the butterflies come and see the milkweed. They lay eggs on the milkweed so that when the caterpillars come out, they have food.
Yeah.
Because the only food the monarchs can eat, the little caterpillars, is the milkweed. So it's a symbiotic relationship. And so when I see the little caterpillars, I bring them inside and I nurture them until they make their chrysalis. And then I keep the chrysalis, and it's like 10 days before they come out a butterfly. And you got to keep them by an open window so they know the light, they know the temperature. And then you release them. And so you're just protecting. Because I had the horror of watching a wasp eat the heads off of my little monarch. And that was early on, before I knew anything about them. And I was so excited. I had these three caterpillars, you know. And then I'm watching as a wasp comes first.
Yeah.
And so the wasp, John says, are Republicans. But they ate the heads off of these guys. And so I was motivated to want to bring them inside. I didn't want to have, you know, an endangered species being devoured by the monsters out here.
Right,
you know,
right.
I was like... So at any rate, so last year I had like 30 of the little buddies that I got
to
the
Very impressive. That's harder than feeding chickens, I'll tell you that.
Well, I got to tell you, that is the most exciting is that you're out in the dirt and you realize out of this soil comes a plant that is going to nourish this species is going to fly to Mexico, and you feel so integrated the butterflies I raise here or that I nurture are the ones that actually go to Mexico. This particular...
Yeah, that's the part I didn't understand. Anyway, well, maybe we ought to do a show on the monarchs. And I'll tell you what, the problem out here, we don't see hardly any of them. There's so much petrochemicals used in the farmland around my 10 acres that we hardly see very many of them. And same thing with the chimney swifts and the swallows, the birds. We watched them over 20 years out here. We used to have hundreds of swallows and chimney swifts. And now we're down to, you know, just maybe three, four dozen at the most, at the absolute most. And we've seen that.
Well, they say there's 300,000, I think, species of birds that have gone extinct, and it's so staggering. My heart is so broken.
Honeybees? You know, even honeybees. All of our bees now we have very few honeybees even out here. The 10 acres is a refuge. It's surrounded by petrochemical plowed ground that grows corn and soybeans.
It's beyond a tragedy. It's a real threat to the survival of the planet. We are at that moment, and you know, for us to scream to the high heavens, you know, I mean, we have the environmental advisory boards where, you know, we're trying so hard. All of the little volunteers, you know, are moms and grandmoms and are on these EABs, and they're trying to say, stop using Roundup. Meanwhile, our neighbor on one side has, you know, uses Roundup all the time. There's not a weed in his yard, not a bird, not a bee, not nothing. But right next door where we are, we don't use any of that stuff, and we have birds and bees and butterflies, and, you know, so it's like you can either be, so we're in transition. You know, the ethical shift.
Yeah.
The ethical shift is here, and the more people who wake up and do what they can do, great. So we're trying to outlaw. You know, you go into outlaw Roundup. You know, so you, They know it causes cancer. They know people are dying of cancer, and they don't care. Your kid could die of cancer with Roundup. Still, you want no weeds in your yard? Wow. So at any rate, so I made a sign. I'll send it to you. That's what you could show. You could show my sign. I have my my signs that I just made. I'll send them to you right now. And it say no toxins in parks, as if you have to say that. Why do you have to say that? Our kids play there. Why do we have to say that? But there you have it. Mm. All right, I'm going to give you back to John because he really is chomping at the bit. Thanks for having me. That was very kind of you.
Well, thank you. It's really good and pleasant as hell. Thank you.
All right, here he is.
It's pleasant
as
hell. Hey, brother. So there you go, listeners. Lou Ann.
Well, that's the literary critic Lou Ann there, yeah.
Yeah, right. That's wonderful.
Yeah, she loves it. Yeah, I've started reading it. It's really great. In fact, talking about these guys working on this house building and new windows, stashes and all that, that's what I'm doing with my back garage. I'm painting it today. And it's like I feel some affinity with these guys in the story.
Right. It's a hell of a story, and it's written by a guy who did the work. He was actually, what he did.
Exactly. He knows of what he's talking
Robert,
about.
His real name is Robert Noonan, and he wrote under it. And it's a there's a big backstory to that. And speaking of backstories, John, did you know that now we're all supposed to, according to the front page of In These Times issue, is that Workers of the World Unite Against Amazon. That's the cover story on this week in These Times. But nevertheless, there's always something dividing. These are the contradictions. HBO, well, I think, yes, Kate Winslet, a British woman. British. The British have invaded Philadelphia. Did you know that? The suburbs of Philadelphia, a film crew has been putting out have been filming a, for lack of better terms, working class detective story.
That's supposed to start on Sunday, I think.
I just watched the first episode, and it takes place, folks, in Pennsylvania, in John Grant land, right outside.
Oh, well, I'm going to have to check. Yeah, I wanted to see that, so I didn't know it started. I can pick it up on demand. Yeah.
It is it's an amazingly well-told.
Oh, good. She's one of my favorite actresses, Kate Winslet. She's incredible. Yeah.
You're going to be. I don't know. I don't know anything. Wasn't she the one?
She was. She was when she was younger, of course, with Gerard or whatever his name and an actor. She was on the Titanic. She was the one that the girl on the bow with Leonardo DiCaprio. You know.
Oh, that was her. Oh my God!
That's Kate Winslet.
That's what.
But she matures, she's. Just a great presence. She's a wonderful actress. She was married to that rogue kind of rich British. He owns an airline. He's one of these romantic sort of capitalists. She very famously there was a fire, and I guess this guy's mother was there, and Kate Winslet went in the fire and pulled the mother out. You know. So, you know, she's a down and dirty person. She's good. And
the politically incorrect term, I'll use it. She's an incredible actress. And
Braniff is the name.
Okay. Oh, really? Okay.
She may still be married to Braniff, yeah.
Well, this is, she really, I mean, you check it out, John, because you won't believe that it's her. I listeners, I'm telling you, it's incredible. Yeah, I'm weak on detective stories. I really like them, but this one is real. This filmed in the suburbs of Pennsylvania, of Philadelphia.
Yeah, I'm gonna check it out. Yeah.
On location, I can't believe
there
it.
There it is. This is our little hood here. In fact, we're and you know, as I say, Luann is this group acronym of CARSI. You know, she says has 1,000 members of mostly women, who take on the cops here, in various ways. I'm trying to work with them, it's kind of weird, here I am, And I've been working with the cops longer before these, this group. I have a track record here for way back. But anyway, you know how this goes. So
when I always get uncomfortable, I just say, well, I'm here as a reporter.
Well, that's exactly what I do too. You got it. You and I are the same way that way. And that's what a lot of people in the Vets for Peace movement don't understand about me. All of those people think of themselves as veteran activists. Well, I started out as a journalist. That's where my that's where my tricks are, and that's where my muscles work. And I'm always coming at these things a little differently as a reporter or a writer, journalist, as you are.
I know it's a special moment when I find myself with my mouth is hanging open and I'm wanting to take a picture or write down. That's what, or I'm wanting to get the hell out of there because something bad's going to happen.
Right, of course. Uh-oh. I'm getting a bad vibe here.
but I don't leave. I still stay there. Then I end up with my mouth open, going, I don't
Well, that's because that's because you have integrity and you have courage. And you have to. All that shit.
I don't think they get that.
Right. I know.
I'll tell you that this is the crazy part about the world today. I mean, I just happened to. Like I said, this morning I woke up and I turned this thing on, and it's Kate Winslet playing this working class woman detective in the working class. Not all suburbs are wealthy suburbs. Philadelphia.
No.
Same thing.
Yeah,
Kansas
it could be
City.
Something like Upper Darby or something. I don't know. I have to check it out.
No, this is a really rough type of. Suburb, I'm like, wow, it's filmed there. It's filmed in those suburbs,
Yeah, that's what I mean. Well, maybe Upper Darby rather than Montgomery County where we live. It's not exactly. Well, I mean, there's obviously working class people here, but Montgomery County has a lot of money. We don't have some of it, but it's a wealthy county. Whereas the more working class would be like Upper Darby and things like that.
Well, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, other than go to Virginia and get your pot.
I beg your pardon? What do you mean?
I said I don't know what to tell you except go to Virginia and get your pot because
wherever it's
legal? Maryland.
Yeah.
I think.
Well, my nephew, the veterinarian, who has a bad back, lives in Virginia. He teaches there, and he. he has a license now, to use medical marijuana. So, David. I say, David, that's interesting. Well, the family's all getting together in North Carolina on July 4th. So, I shared some of my brownies with with my nephew David, and I'm threatening with him. We're conspiring to. Get my brothers. Hey, Dick, Ed, how would you like a brownie?
Yeah, right. Hey.
And then we're going to sit here and tell stories, And
let's do some medicine.
Yeah, I thought we'd have a story, a Grant story hour where my two brothers and I would compare stories. I want you to tell me a story of something you were involved in and did in South Dade County, Florida, when we were all kids there, that your two brothers don't know about,
Right, there you go.
And, I mean, I have a few choice ones. You did that? You did what?
Yeah, out there with the tomato farmers.
Exactly.
Uh-oh.
You later, mate. There it is. Cowboy.